300 Quaker, probably in the spot. They feel the door, they
turn the cage. Okay, I'm on the northbound actor. Just right at the light.
Look, I think, Carl, what the hell can they do? And I think we can set it up again.
If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/ganglandwire. Follow true crime storyteller Gary Jenkins on Twitter at Jenks Law. Buy the DVD Gangland Wire or download the Kansas City Mob Tour app. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Welcome, folks. I'm back here with my good friend, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
We are at our offsite, continuing in the exciting story of the great parachutist hijacking, or skyjacking, 1972, with our friend Martin J. McNally. Max, say hello to everybody.
Hello, everybody.
So I know by now you've been listening to these episodes. If you haven't been, go back and listen to the last three episodes.
We might be more than three episodes in here, I'm afraid.
Are we on our fourth episode?
I think we might even be to the five.
Maybe five. I don't know. I'm lost track. But you just look in the iTunes, it will tell you whether it's part one, two, three, four, or five. And the show notes will tell you a little bit about what it's about. We have taken him from the early youth, descent into some criminal behavior and his grand plan to make $500,000 by skyjacking an American Airlines plane and then parachute out.
Which he did do. He did make $500,000.
He got $500,000 and he parachuted out. There was a little problem on the way down with the parachute, though, wasn't there, Mac?
There was a big problem.
The money and the body parted companies on the way down. And
yes, it did.
And a farmer found the $500,000.
Yeah, he did.
And he turned it in.
Yeah, every bit of it.
Every bit of it. You got to have to admire a guy, I guess, that can do that. I mean, you think about it. You could take that money, and we were talking about this on the way down. I could take that money and just stick it in, in the garage.
Yes.
And when I had, two or three years from now, or even 6 months from now, when I wanted to go out to eat dinner, I'd just go get
a couple of 20s.
A few 20s. And slowly but surely, over the next few years, every time I want to buy something that I paid cash for, which I normally might use a credit card, I'd just go get money out and pay that.
You could do that for life.
You could do it. Yeah, you just make your life a little bit easier for life, and nobody would ever know.
That's right.
As long as you didn't tell. You know what they say? Two of us can keep a secret if one of us is dead.
Yes.
So don't tell anybody. And Mac made the mistake of telling too many people about this skyjacking. And so one of them started talking to...
Was it too many?
It was more than two.
Because there was a guy who had a wife.
But there was definitely one too many.
Four, five, six, maybe 10 people probably knew about this.
You shouldn't have told anybody, Mac. And
I know.
Hindsight's always 20/20.
One of the guys you were kind of enrolling to be your accomplice in the whole event, and then he got cold feet because of his wife?
Yeah, he got cold feet because he couldn't parachute out. He said, I can't parachute out.
Yeah, I don't blame him.
I got cold feet. I can't do that.
And your feet got cold, but they were hanging off the back of a 727 at 10,000 feet before you actually did parachute out of the plane.
You got to picture this, folks.
Hanging over the stairs, feeling 300 mile an hour air going over my feet.
Just picture that. It's like a cartoon. He's hanging on to the bottom stair. He's got 40 pounds of money strapped to his leg. He's got a parachute on, and he's like streaming in the wind behind this airplane going about 300 mile an hour at about 10,000 feet, I believe.
At 2 in the morning.
At 2 in the morning.
Pitch black.
He doesn't know if he's over Lake Michigan or if he's over some soft plowed farmland or over a city.
Well, he knew his altitude. He knew his direction. He knew the approximate speed because he'd been to the cockpit beforehand.
Yeah.
To check those things with the altimeter, and that would have been a little dicey because the pilot was a pilot, the co-pilot was a pilot, but the guy that was a navigator worked for the FBI.
Yeah.
Yes, the flight engineer.
The flight engineer.
He had a gun in his hand, too. That bomb wanted to kill
me. I guess y'all just all feel lucky he didn't run back there at the back and pop you while you were hanging off the back.
Yes, he could have done that. If
he just didn't think of it in time.
If he'd have known that I was hanging on the stairs, that's exactly what he would have done.
Now you you corrected me in one thing. I thought it was because the pilot knew when you left because you would have opened the back door, but the back door was already open. Yeah, and you corrected me. You said the pilot knew because there was
a weight differential
when your body left the airplane. Why he felt it in the yoke?
Yes.
There. Yeah, that's
yoke.
Yeah, that would be
because he was actually flying the plane manually at the time.
He was flying the plane manually, and
so he would just look down and see where he was right then. Plus, there was an FBI tailplane.
Yes.
Who would have then circled around and tried to spot you going down?
What the pilot was supposed to do was when he snapped that I had gone out, he was supposed to turn on the exterior lights to alert the trail plane. And then what the FBI trail plane would have done was come in and circle and probably make a pass on me to collapse my chute with the turbulence from their plane. But I would have been dead in the water if he had turned on those exterior lights.
But he didn't turn them on, so they
for about
know.
3 minutes.
Okay.
And you fell away from the plane, and you didn't pull the parachute at first.
In 3 minutes, I was on the ground practically.
It was interesting because as he talked about in the last episode, landing and getting onto the ground and kind of collecting, or maybe it was the episode before that where he collects up the parachute. He kind of counts himself out. When they hand him the equipment on the plane, they give him a reserve chute and not a main chute. And he knew that.
Yeah, you got a lot of balls, man.
He'd had some experience with parachutes because he was in the Navy working on airplanes.
Yeah, he'd seen a parachute.
I knew what reserve chutes were.
He at least
emergency
knew what they were.
Chutes.
Well, it worked. All's well that ends well. You're on the ground. You get back to Wyandotte, Michigan, suburb of Detroit.
You have a friend pick you up in Peru, Indiana.
Yes, he did.
After he's a little hesitant too, but you called him again, and he came back down.
I had to pester him.
He was the same guy This is the same guy who came with you to St. Louis.
Yes.
To drop you off at the airport.
Yes, same guy.
The same guy who didn't want to bail out of an airplane because he was scared.
He knew when I called him to pick me up that the money had been found.
Yeah.
A couple of days before, so he knew I was broke. But I told him, don't worry about that. I'll grab another plane here in a couple of weeks.
He was a good friend to you.
Yeah.
He was truly a good friend. Anyhow, you're back. One of your other friends, not really friend, Bukowski, James, what was that name again?
James Palczak.
Palczak.
And he's the guy that turned me in. And then
he called the Detroit
James,
cop.
James Petty.
And then
the
Detroit cop calls the FBI. The FBI goes to Petty, and they convince Petty. Then Petty finally verifies. Now, that's where we are now. We are at the FBI is closing in on you. They figured out where you live by now.
Yes, they knew where I lived.
What'd they do next?
What they did was me and James Petty went to the Big Boy restaurant in Trenton, Michigan, the Big Boy.
The Bob's Big Boy?
The Big Boy. Bob's Big Boy, I think. But we stopped and we had coffee, I think. The two FBI agents were about three cars over.
So they were following you. They had you under surveillance,
they were at the restaurant watching us. I didn't snap to any of that. I explained to Jim exactly what happened. Then we went back to his house. We weren't there but 20 minutes or so. We went back to his house. He stood on the steps of his house. He had a very nice house. He said, okay, I'll see you later. Usually, I would always go into his house when we came back from having a coffee. I'd come back to his house and talk to him and his wife. And so forth. And this time he said, okay, I'll see you later. At that point there, I knew something.
You knew that was a red flag, wasn't it?
That was a red flag. And I said, I was speechless. And I looked around and I saw a car across the street shouldn't have been there.
With a 30, 40-year-old white guy wearing a coat and tie.
there was a car across the street.
Was it and, Michigan plates, or you didn't see?
I didn't look at the plates, but it definitely was out of place. And I looked at that car and I snapped it. Something doesn't look right. I got in my car, my 65 Ford. I left the area, but as I think back on it now, I should have went around the block and got out of my car and looked. I should have watched his house to see what was happening there. If I had done that, I would have seen two FBI agents come up to Petty's house and talk to him. And at that point there, he would have told him, yeah, he's the guy. You know, he's definitely did that score down in St. Louis. But I didn't do that. I left there and I went over to an old friend of mine, Clayton Drury. He's a ex-convict. He'd been in Michigan Penitentiary for about 8 years. But he was an old friend, a trusted friend. And I went over to his house. That was the first time I had seen him since I had probably over a year, because he was convicted in federal court of possession of a firearm. But he had gotten out on Monday. He'd gotten out
the Monday that you made it back to Wyandotte.
He got out of prison on Monday. He was in the Terre Haute Penitentiary. The thing that's startling about this is that his woman, Joni Castle, had tried to call me on Thursday. She tried to call me on Thursday at about 5 p.m. And she was going to tell me that Clayton is going to be released on this Monday. The writ that he had filed had been successful. I didn't get that phone call because me and Pelikowski had started for St. Louis at 3 p.m. on that Thursday. But if I had gotten that call from her, I would have canceled the trip to St. Louis. Okay? I would have canceled it. But the series of events that happened, I didn't get the phone call. He got out on Monday. I saw him on Wednesday, the night that I was arrested. I was over at his house from, maybe 7 or 8 o'clock, I think it was, maybe 7 or 8 o'clock, until about 11:05 when I left his house. I left he and Joni going back to my place, and I had mentioned to him that, you heard about what happened in St. Louis with that skyjacking? He said, yeah, I heard it. I said, that was me. He says, no way. I said, yeah, that was me. I lost the money and I got all fucked up. So he didn't believe it, but so I'm going home.
Well, but your face is still probably bruised up and a little lacerated.
Yeah, it was still a little bruised up and everything. No question about it.
From your hard landing.
From the parachute, it hit me in the head. Yeah. So I'm driving home, and as I'm down 16th Street, about a block and a half from my house, I see a lot of cars that seem unusual. And on the corner of the street there, just before hitting my street, I noticed a car on the left-hand side, right at the corner, and it was filled with people. I didn't see who was in it, but it was filled with people. I thought that was definitely unusual and made me extremely paranoid. So as I'm driving down the street, the car that's over on the left blinks its lights. Bleep, 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 bleep. It blinked its lights. And then I knew something was really up. And so I'm driving down the street, going to my house, slow. I'm not going to stop at my house. I'm gonna pass my house.
Like there's too many cars around and
there's too
people
many cars
and cars.
Around. Too many difficult circumstances here that are unusual. So as I pass my house, about 10 or 15 feet, a car pulls out and blocks my the right of way, my movement. Pulls out, and people jump out of this thing, and at that point there. I know the jig's up. I could have put my car in low gear, floored it, and that car would have took off like a bullet. I would have gone over the curb and gone on my way. I didn't do that for a very good reason. Joseph Lewisell was a mob attorney in Detroit, and he had told me in a case that I had for possession of slugs, quarter slugs, he told me that never run from the cops, ever. If they're ever coming down on you, let the arrest go down smooth, because there may be something in that arrest that is going to get you off.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking about Lewisell. I stopped the car. There must have been 20 agents there. They had rifles, pistols, and everything pointing at me. Get out of the car. Get out of the car. My window was down at this time. And I put my hands up, got my foot on the brake. And I said, I got to turn off the engine. And at that point there, they stood down pretty much so. They weren't frisky. I said, I got to turn off the engine. I got to put it in park. So I said, okay, go ahead. So I took my hand down, turned off the engine, put it in park. They said, okay, step out. So I stepped out of the car. I think it was Neil Welch, the director of the Detroit FBI. He said, are you Martin McNally? I said, who? He said, are you Martin McNally? I said, who's he? And the chief of police in Wyandotte was there, too. And he knew me. He said, that's him. That's him. So Neil Welch said, Martin McNally, you're being arrested for suspicion of aircraft piracy. I said, what? And he says, yeah, you're under arrest. I said, oh, all right, okay. So they put my hands on the car and they frisked me.
Did you have a weapon on you at the time?
No.
Because the gun that you had modified when you hijacked the plane, which was a .45, wasn't a machine gun.
No.
They would say. You had a .25 caliber.
I had a 32. I think it was a 25 or 32 caliber Beretta.
Beretta.
I had thrown
that out when the sheriff in Peru picked you up on the side of the road.
I threw that out, and that was found a couple of days later. So they put me in handcuffs and put me in the car. These agents in the front seat and over in, to my left, they gave me my Miranda rights. And they wanted me to sign the card on my rights. And I said, I'm not signing anything. And they said, well, now that we have you arrested, is it okay if we go into your house to look around? And I said, no, you can't go into my house. And if you did go into my house before a search warrant, you blew this case out of the water, you know, illegal search. I said that, you know, so I'm not authorizing anything. So they took me down to the Detroit Federal Building. We went in there. What time was it? About 11:30, maybe quarter to midnight that we got there. And I said, I need to make a phone call. And they wouldn't let me make a phone call right away, but eventually I got a phone call. And they made the call. They said, who are you calling? I said, I'm calling Arnold Shapiro, an attorney. The FBI agent made the call and got this guy on the phone. Told me later that this guy sounded like he knew that you were under arrest. Well, I didn't find out until later that he did know, because James Paulzak had Arnold Shapiro as his attorney. And James Paulzak certainly told Arnold Shapiro that I was going to be arrested for that skyjacking in St. Louis.
Now, he had him as his attorney beforehand,
because he
knew something was going to come down.
Arnold Shapiro was both of our attorneys, okay? He was a very good criminal attorney. I'm talking to him on the phone. He says, don't say anything at all. I'll be down there in the morning. Keep your mouth shut. So in the morning, he came down to the federal building. But in the meantime, I would imagine before 2 o'clock in the morning, they also got calls from three other attorneys. My dad had been notified, and he sent an attorney down. A woman by the name of Kay Skoloff, an attorney in Detroit, she had heard it on the news. This thing hit the news very fast.
That they had caught you.
They had caught me.
Yeah.
Had been arrested. I mean, everybody and his brother knew that I was under arrest on this.
But this was just at this point, you were really only a suspect, even if you were the prime suspect.
That's true. I was just a suspect. But
case like this, the FBI calls a press conference immediately.
They had news media at the federal building very fast.
Yeah.
And they took a bunch of photographs of me. The FBI did and passed these photos out to the news media. In the morning, that very same day, they had people flying in from all over the place for a lineup. I stood a lineup, and I found out later that one of the FBI agents told one of the stewardesses who they had under arrest and what I was wearing. Okay? That came out in court. It's a misidentification.
Before they actually had her come and try to identify who
when the hijacker was. When she came to the federal building, she was uncertain who I was because I had that wig on.
Mm-hmm.
But the FBI agent told her that what I was wearing in the lineup. And minor point, really, but they do those things. And they identified me. I forget what I had to say in the lineup. I forget that. Doesn't come to mind.
There was maybe some line that you had said when you were on,
the plane? Some line that I had said on the plane for the voice identification.
Bring me a parachute.
Bring me a
parachute. And the other people in the lineup, do you have any idea who they were at all?
They were FBI agents.
They were just plants there to fill in
the field.
Yeah.
They had about 7 or 8 of them. But everybody picked out me.
And wasn't it kind of funny that everybody's wearing a coat and tie except you? You had on a t-shirt and blue jeans.
Everybody's got close cropped hair.
Everybody's got real close hair. Yours is long.
Yeah.
Didn't you think that was kind of funny?
Yeah. No, my hair was short at the time.
But your attorney had said, don't say anything, so you don't say anything.
To the FBI.
Yeah.
In the lineup, you have to say something.
By not saying anything, he means don't answer questions.
Yeah.
But
don't answer questions.
Wait. Say, make this statement.
So if they say, make this statement,
it's not incriminating.
Yes, it is.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is, because they're going, well, can you repeat this line that the hijacker said so we can see if you sound like him? That's why they ask it.
They can do that.
And you can't say, I refuse.
No, in the lineup, they can do that.
Well, yeah, you can refuse.
They can't force you to say the line.
Apply electric shock therapy to you.
I'm just saying, they're not asking you that, like, hey, can you pick me up a bag of peanuts at the supermarket?
Yeah, when Arnold Shapiro said, don't say anything, he was talking about
talking to
the FBI. Talking about any of this stuff. And I knew up front that I'm not talking about anything.
Yeah.
Because here's what people do. They think they're smarter than who they're talking to. And so they're going to talk their way out of this thing.
Yeah.
And every time you talk your way out of this thing, you incriminate yourself. I've seen it happen. I don't know how many times.
Yes.
They will incriminate themselves thinking they're smarter than who they're talking to. And
trying
to be cool. And it doesn't work. It's the best job. The best thing is just don't say a word.
Don't say anything.
Don't say a thing.
Give me an attorney. Yeah. Call me an attorney. Yeah.
Take me back to my cell. That's the best thing to do.
So we stood this lineup, and the next, I think that same day of the lineup, they had me in court. Federal court, and going out of the FBI building, they had all these media there taking videos and whatever else. They put me in a car and then drove over to the federal building, federal courthouse. We went into court. They read the charges and everything. You're charged with this and boop. They didn't ask me to plead guilty or anything. They just said, these are the charges, and it's in St. Louis, so, We're gonna bond you. They made a bond. They set a bond at $100,000. My attorney, I think it was either Shapiro or John Bain. They were partners. Asked for a reduction in the bond to $25,000. Now, if the judge had gone along with that, my dad would have put up the money and I'd have been released on bond. But no, the judge wanted $100,000 cash bond.
They wouldn't give you like 10% of the whatever the bond is.
I don't think so. Cash bond, $100,000.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure. They take me over to the county jail or whatever. So I'm in jail under arrest. It's all over the news. That night, Walt Pelikowski was in, or maybe it was the next day. But Walt Pelikowski was in one of the restaurants there in Ecorse. And his father came in with a newspaper and laid it on the table in front of Walt. He said, did you have anything to do with this? No. So now this is let's say, 24 hours after my arrest.
Mm-hmm.
Boom. 11 or 12 o'clock at night. 2 hours later, Walt was in a bar or something, but he left the bar, went back home. He came up to the door, and his wife, Faye, was there. He said, what should I do? Or Faye said, what are you going to do? So Walt said, I'm going to go turn myself in. Now, it had been announced by the FBI that they wanted to know how I got back from Peru, Indiana, to Michigan. Mm-hmm. They knew all the other things, how I got to Peru, Indiana, bailed out. Yeah.
But they didn't know how you got to St. Louis.
But they didn't know how I got from Peru, Indiana, to Detroit. Mm-hmm. About 2 o'clock in the morning, maybe. He walked into the River Rouge Police Department and told the sergeant at the desk. The sergeant at the desk knew Walt, by the way. He said, I'm here to turn myself in. The guy said, Walt, what are you turning yourself in about? He said, well, the FBI wants to know how this McNally got back from St. Louis to Detroit. And I took him. I brought him back here from Peru, Indiana, to Detroit. Guy says, well, you'll have to wait here. He called the FBI. Within 15, 20 minutes, they had agents there at the River Roof Police Department, and they were talking to Walt. He made a statement. And his first statement was there was no culpability in that statement. They said, you can go. You didn't do anything. But as he's walking the door, he says, but if you did anything and we find out that you're involved in this thing, we'll come after you and arrest you. He says, so you need to come over here again and sit down and tell us exactly what happened, what you know. So Walt sat down again and made a second statement. Some of the statements that he made created culpability. They said, well, we're going to have to hold you for further proceedings on this because you were involved. So what you need to do, since you were involved, you need to tell us everything about this, everything that happened, and come clean. On his third statement, he told them everything. Spill the beans.
What happened to the attorneys?
He didn't have any attorneys.
Oh.
I'm the one who had the attorney. He came in there without any attorney himself, and he wanted to turn himself in to let the FBI know how I got back from Bruniani. Now, that's exactly what I told him not to do. Mm-hmm. I said, they'll come to you anyway, but keep your mouth shut and deny everything. They took him the next morning, so it's about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. The next morning, within 7 or 8 hours, he's in court being charged with aiding and abetting or aircraft piracy. And so he gets into court, and then they bring him over to jail, I think. But when he comes into jail, he wasn't on my range, but he was in an area where I could talk to him. And it wasn't long before he came to me and he told me, all these guys are screwing with me, harassing me, giving me a rough time. I says, what's happening?
You mean the other guys in jail?
Yeah, the other guys in jail.
Not the police or
the
FBI.
I said, what? I don't understand. I mean, what's the deal? Everything was on the news. I didn't have access to the TV or the newspapers. I didn't know that Walt had actually turned himself in, walked into the police department, and admitted involvement in this case. I didn't know that. I didn't find out that until much later.
But the fact that he was there seemed to kind of give you some sense that maybe they suspected him, or
well,
but he didn't say, I just told him everything.
No, he didn't. He didn't do that. He just said I was arrested. But all these guys over on his part of the range were reading the papers and everything that they had that I didn't have, and it was clearly spelled out. This guy turned himself in. Now, what stupid criminal would turn himself in? I mean, you got to be a retard.
Now, were they harassing him because snitches get stitches?
Yeah, snitches get stitches. And that's probably what it was. But I didn't know I didn't know he was giving all these statements. I didn't find out about those three statements until much, much later in this case. Much later.
Like they just withheld that information?
They withheld it. And I couldn't get it in discovery, but my attorney did get it in discovery. So he knew what was happening. Now, when we went into court, they set a bond for him. I had my bond. They appointed one attorney for Walt. Somebody told Walt in jail that he's charged with a capital crime, so he's entitled to two attorneys. When Walt went back in the court, he says, I'm entitled to two attorneys. And I said, well, I don't know anything about that, but tell the judge. So he did tell the judge, and the judge did appoint him two attorneys right there. And they set us up for transfer to St. Louis because we weren't going to do a Rule 20 on pleading guilty in St. Louis. That wasn't going to happen. Within, I'd imagine, 2 weeks, we were in St. Louis at the county jail.
Awaiting basically arraignment? Had they filed specific charges against
yes,
you?
Yes, the arraignment occurred. We were arrested in Detroit. The arraignment, actual arraignment, and filing of the actual indictment, that came in St. Louis.
So what was that about a search, a bad search?
Okay, I don't think we've discussed this, but I was arrested.
They had asked you if you'd given permission to search your house.
They asked for permission.
And you didn't give it.
No. What happened on this is this, and I didn't find this out until much later. When we got down to St. Louis, the judge had set this case for a very fast trial. I told the judge, I says, we've got to set this trial off. We haven't done our investigation. I don't know what happened in this case, how I got arrested, why the arrest went down, and we got to investigate. What can we do to get a delay? And he said, there's only one way. You'll need to file a motion for a competency evaluation. So I said, file it. Get that filed. And how long will that be? He said, 30, 60, 90 days delay. I said, that's what you need to do, and we need to investigate this. He filed a motion, judge granted it, and I was sent down to Springfield Medical Center, along with my...
Springfield, Illinois?
No, Missouri.
Springfield, Missouri.
They have a federal hospital down there, and that's where they send everybody for...
Did I say Illinois?
No, you just said Springfield.
You just said Springfield. I just wanted to clarify.
Yeah, Springfield, Missouri.
Missouri.
Yeah, Springfield, Missouri. Walt, too, was given a competency evaluation. So both of us went down there. My attorney, Frederick Mayer, filed a motion to have... expenses paid for him to go to Detroit. The judge would not pay for a second attorney to go. And I told my attorney, I says, I want both of you to go. So talk to my father, and he'll give you the money for your expenses going both of you to Detroit. They went to Detroit. They got with my youngest sister. There was Paul Rapaski, was a law student. I think his name's Paul Rapaski. And everybody went around questioning the neighbors in my area. And they came back with some revealing data. And it indicated that the lights in my house had gone on for my arrest and throughout the night of my arrest. Throughout the night. Now, this is well before issuance of a search warrant. They didn't have a search warrant at this time. They didn't get a search warrant until the next day.
Were you not staying at your own house at that point?
I was staying at my house.
And you'd been out that evening, and you never got back into your house.
I had been out. I had been out, and they had been on me, I think, about 7 o'clock.
So what you're saying is they were following you, watching you, and there's another crew inside your house looking around, probably.
Well, they lost me at Petty's. When I left Jim Petty's house at about... 5 or 6 o'clock, and went over to Clayton Drury's house in Riverview, I think it was. Now, they lost track of me. At 7 p.m., an arrest warrant came in from Washington, D.C., I believe. And so they had authorization to arrest me at 7 o'clock. But they didn't see me until I came by my house at about a couple minutes after 11 p.m. Data that I got is that lights were going on in my house before my arrest, and throughout the night. And neighbors, especially Mrs. Hicks, who lived right next door, she actually saw people going in the back door. She was snoopy anyway, but she was a good woman.
She'd be willing to testify to this in court.
She did. I had all these neighbors coming into court talking about what had happened.
And this was in the appellant case.
Not in the original case, but
when you appealed?
No, this is in the original case.
Okay.
In the original transcript. We had a suppression hearing that lasted about a week. So we had probably 40 or 50 witnesses coming in to testify. One FBI agent testified that they weren't concerned about the lights in my house because they knew I had an electronic timer in the house that turned lights on and off. I think he said on and off.
Mm-hmm.
But when that happened, when I heard that testimony, I told my Fred, my lawyer, I said, Fred, nobody, absolutely nobody knew I had a timer in my house to turn those lights on. They didn't turn lights off. They turned them on at about maybe 10 p.m. every night.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, this indicates that they were in my house before that issuance of the search warrant. After the suppression hearing, my attorney, Frederick Mayer, came into the U.S. Marshal's cage. And he says, Mac, the motion to suppress is going to be denied. I talked to Judge Regan, and he told me that if this case wasn't so big, he would suppress the evidence in the house. But because it's so big, he won't do that. And if it is suppressed, it'll have to come from a higher court. My attorney should have filed a motion for recusal.
Yeah.
With an affidavit to support the motion, affidavit of prejudice, and whatever else.
To recuse the judge.
To recuse the judge, to have him off the case, and that particular incident would have been published throughout the area, throughout the media, that this judge is being kicked off for the statement that he made to my attorney in chambers, that he would dismiss the charges if it wasn't such a big case. If it was a minor marijuana case, something like this. But this thing was so huge, he wasn't going to do it. Okay? I appealed on that particular issue, and I went before the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. I raised, I think, four issues.
Yeah, I think that was one of the elements that I had been able to find online.
That was a big issue in the case, and the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals denied it. Okay? They denied it.
They were a higher court.
Yes.
But
a higher court.
Nonetheless, because the actual case was so high profile.
Sometimes murder cases get dismissed on illegal searches.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? But the fact of the matter is, I had all the testimony, all the evidence. The case weren't so big it was dismissed the charges. Now, here's something. On the fruit of the poisonous tree, you know that.
Sure.
If you've got an arrest and you've got a bogus search, under the fruit of the poisonous tree, all evidence that comes after that has to be suppressed.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about the entire case. They got all this evidence out of my house. It was an illegal search. I would have walked. And I'm telling you, I figured I was going to walk. They offered me a deal. Attorney came to me. He says, Mac, if you plead guilty, the judge will sentence you to no more than 28 years. And he had my brothers and sisters in the federal building down here. They came in from Detroit. And they were in the room. And everybody said, plead guilty. You know, you did it. Plead guilty. And I told everybody, I said, I would, but there was an illegal search in this case. And under no circumstances will I plead guilty. It's going to go to court and whatever. I would have had a 28-year sentence if I'd have pled guilty.
And if you had pled guilty, would they force you to serve the entire 28?
No. What happens on this is that in all of these things, I didn't know. I didn't know the law. But two-thirds of the time, you do two-thirds of the 28, and you go home on a mandatory release.
But that was 28 total because you were actually had two air piracy charges.
It would have been 28 total, period. If I could go back and do that over, I would take the plea. Because here's something else that Fred told me. He said, the judge will allow you to appeal the suppression of the evidence issue, and you'll be able to take that issue to the Court of Appeals. And if that is suppressed, then there may be a dismissal of the entire case. You can do that. Now, like I said, I didn't know the law. I didn't know about motion for recusal, and I didn't know about, you know, all the things that he was talking there.
Well, this was, you're dealing with the court system here, you're dealing with the court system in St. Louis, where the offense occurred, if you will. I mean, it's a huge public media circus of what had happened all the way through, really, to your arrest.
Yes.
And then they're releasing photos of you, and they're just fueling the fire. could you, I mean, you, I think I was reading you tried to change for a motion for a change of venue.
Change of venue. I needed to go elsewhere.
Where would you go? That would be
100 miles from here.
You think that that would have made a difference in, as opposed difference. To being?
A little difference. When Pelikowski pled guilty on November the 29th, I think it was, my trial was to begin on December the 4th. Everybody in St. Louis would have heard that on the news, on the radio. It was all over the radio, all over the TV. Walter Pelikowski pleads guilty and McNally's going to court. I knew I was dead in the water.
Read down on the when they made their decision and found against him on that and upheld the search, they said that they heard the witnesses and the FBI agents testified that they saw the lights come on and go off, but they didn't go in the house, and they didn't talk about the other witnesses, but Mike just said that he had neighbors that saw people in and out of the house and saw the lights go off and on. The ruling on that was it's to the jury's discretion, and maybe this was a judge tried, it's probably a jury trial, I'm sure it was, the jury decides on who's telling the truth and who's not, and you can't go back and question their judgment after that because they're the ones that have seen the witnesses actually testify. Mm-hmm. So if they decide that, okay, those witnesses that are saying people are going in and out of the house, either they didn't know what they were talking about or they were intentionally lying, and we believe the FBI agent that says they did not go in and out of the house before the search warrant, they can believe that. And the upper court will not hear new evidence. They won't go have those witnesses come back. They only go on the trial transcript. So you don't get a chance to put evidence on again.
A second time.
And
so even though the FBI might have said, well, there might have been somebody in there, but it wasn't us.
It wasn't us, right.
Whether that's true or not.
They testified to that. You know, it's true or not, but it doesn't matter. What matters is what the jury who actually saw them testify and be cross-examined, what they believe.
Between them and the other witnesses.
You don't challenge that. You do not challenge that.
And once they were able to get that, once the jury decided that, you know, we're going to accept this evidence.
Right.
Whatever that evidence was that was in the house.
It's a moot point after that.
Yeah.
They're not going to go back and call those witnesses back in front of the appellate court unless there's some extraneous information, some other information that shows.
Like one of the agents steps forward to say, I was in the house. Yeah, I did search
exactly.
it. That's how come we knew there was a timer on the light.
Yeah, something like that.
But
they would.
I'm kind of curious, though, what would it be that they would find in the house when he took a lot of the materials that he needed to do the crime with him?
Oh, there would be notes. There would be,
if he was working through like the documents to figure out what it was he needed to do.
Yeah, we didn't ask him what the evidence
was. We would have to ask him. Maybe we can talk about that.
There was some kind of evidence in the house that tied him to that crime. Maybe airline schedules.
Yep.
All kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Why don't we make we'll take a quick break here. I know that Mac just went off to get some more coffee. Gary has a public service announcement.
If you have a problem with drugs or alcohol, or you have a friend, relative, employee, associate that has problems with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. Good night, Aaron.
Good night, Aaron. Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Facebook at Odd-O-Matic Music.